Hi, Stephen here. Thanks for checking out the Civilist podcast. If you like what you hear, please share it with a friend. And if your business or organization is interested in sponsoring this show, we'd love to hear from you. Here we go. Welcome to The Civilist from WUNC and PRI. It's a podcast for everyone who's looking for advice on how to talk together with kindness and respect. I'm your host, Stephen Petro. Millions of Americans suffer from depression. Today, I talk with best-selling author and psychologist Andrew Solomon about stigma and when not to open up to others.
I think it's actually, in some ways, even though it can be traumatic to come out, it's very relaxing to have come out.
He also tells us the best ways you can respond when someone discloses their struggle. And in our New Rules for Better Behavior segment, my revered guest experts are back. They help me field new questions about how to be authentic on social media without becoming a Debbie Downer, whether you really have to go to your brother's baby shower when you're having trouble conceiving, and what to do about some new neighbors who seem practically perfect in every way.
Except for one major problem. They don't shut up.
That's all coming up here on the Civilist Podcast. Now it's time for New Rules for Better Behavior, my kind of happy hour gabfest. I'm joined by two guest experts to help advise you on what to do or not do when it comes to tricky social dilemmas. Back again this week are New York Times writer Kim Severson. She joins us from Georgia Public Broadcasting in Atlanta, and Shireen Marisol Meraji with NPR's Code Switch team. She is in the NPR West studios in Culver City, California. Thanks for coming back.
Our pleasure.
Glad to be here. Both of our pleasures.
Yes.
It's pleasurable.
And mine too. Okay. So before taking our listeners' questions, let me ask you this. What's your pet peeve? And to help you and give you a moment to think, here's mine, at least here's mine today. I have a long list. Last week I was online at the supermarket and the guy ahead of me was chatting on his phone. And it took him twice as long to unload his haul, which slowed down the rest of us. And then he never acknowledged the checker. He just kept talking on the phone. So I'm sorry, checkers are not bots. Bank tellers are not bots. They are people. And I say the person in front of you deserves more attention than your device. So that's my pet peeve. Kim, what's on your mind?
Well, I write about food, you know, and so mine's a little bit restaurant related. I just had this experience last night in which the waiter came up and I hadn't finished eating and he said, "Are you still working on that?" And I felt like, oh my God, yes, I've been slaving for about 20 minutes here. I'm exhausted. Like, I don't want to be thought of like working on my meal, you know? It's like kind of been pleasurable. Like, "Are you still working at that?" And I just feel like I'm sawing away at that steak and whew, I'm exhausted. So I would really like it if waiters quit saying, "Are you working on that?" It's a pleasurable experience. It's not actually work for me to eat my entree.
And, you know, on that note, I would really like servers to wait until everyone has finished before they start clearing the plates, please.
Thank you.
Yes.
Thank you. Thank you.
Shireen, do you agree on that? And what's your pet peeve?
I do agree. Mine's more general. I don't like it when people eat with their mouth open and smack and slurp hot drinks, like slurp their coffee. That drives me bananas. Oh, I can't.
That's Kim, by the way. That was Kim.
Oh, Kim.
Oh, I was just taking a sip of my water. I'm sorry.
You were working on it very hard there.
I was working hard on my water.
It was me, Shireen. I threw her under the bus.
Yeah, I
agree. Those were all kind of food related. That's interesting. We didn't plan that ahead of time.
No, we didn't.
So here's our first listener question.
Hey, Stephen. I always enjoy reading about my friends' lives on Facebook, but I've read some studies that say that these positive photos and the messages about people's great vacations and their job promotions can have a depressive effect on others. I just don't see it that way. I like knowing what's going on with my friends' lives. I never want to be a Debbie Downer on Facebook. But should I always try to be happy too? If these are true friends, I should be able to express myself no matter how I'm feeling, right? And in my case, I have an elderly mother with dementia issues, and sometimes I feel uneasy or guilty sharing some of my frustrations. But it does help me to get friends' advice and support. Should I be using Facebook this way?
So, Kim, you're a social media power user. Why don't you start off our advice this week?
Well, I think absolutely you should use Facebook for this because it's, you know, people have gotten book contracts out of, you know, publicly writing about their life situations on Twitter, on Facebook. I think that it's a great resource and it makes me feel better. I'm like, oh my God, they've had a lousy day with their elderly mother with dementia too. And that has been so helpful. And I think the crowdsourcing piece of Facebook is terrific. Like, you know, somebody may write in and say, you know, I found this great way to make their food more flavorful or whatever it is. I think it's a great thing. However, I will say that Facebook is like a good conversation with people. And I think that you cannot just constantly be writing about how lousy your life is because it's like that guy at the party. You're like, oh my God, I cannot get away from him fast enough when they just keep going on about how lousy their life is. So I say, certainly have honest expressions of the ups and downs of your life, but throw in a few LOL cats now and again, just to lighten it up.
Shireen, how about you?
I totally agree with Kim.
You can't agree. No.
I know. I like everything she said, I completely agree with. I think Facebook can be an online community where people are rooting for you. And if you're having a hard time with your parent with dementia, somebody else might be having a hard time too. And it's a great way to connect. And I mean, basically everything Kim said is right on the money.
I might have to disagree.
High five across the country.
I might have to disagree, but I'm afraid of you, Kim, so I'm not going to. You know, researchers have found that sustained Facebook usage actually can lead to increased envy, misery, and loneliness. Those are words that those reports have used. By seeing sort of all these fabulous selfies and, you know, what are called wealthies, which are pictures of vacations and the amazing new homes that people are building. So I really say put a lid on some of those. And one thing that really did strike me, you know, last year was when Mark Zuckerberg, founder of Facebook, and his wife Priscilla Chan posted about their multiple miscarriages. And they wrote, "The pain is so intense and the grief is so real." And so many people like that wrote them notes, supported them, and I think they found a very strong community, which I have found also by sometimes posting about some very real and authentic things. So, you know, my advice does mirror yours, Kim. Be authentic, don't be a whiner, moderation in all things. And now, let's go to question number two.
Hi, Stephen. My partner and I have been trying to have a baby for quite some time now, and fertility treatments are really time intensive and they're very costly. And there's a large emotional toll that comes along with this. It's just really emotionally grueling. My little brother announced that he and his wife are expecting twins, and I'm really, really happy for them. I think it's great. But what I'm not looking forward to is like the baby shower and all of the stuff that comes before the babies are born. My family is starting to invite us to all of these different things, and I want to make it clear to my family that I really care about these babies, but I might not be ready to attend the upcoming baby shower in a way that makes everybody feel good. I would love your advice on this. Thank you so much.
So I'm really curious about, you know, this phrase, "I might not be ready to attend the upcoming baby shower in a way that makes everybody feel good." Mm. You know, that almost seems like a little bit of an implied threat, even though I have a great deal of empathy for the situation that she's describing. Shireen, does she attend the shower or not, or something else?
This is her little brother, and those babies are going to be her nieces or nephews or niece and nephew, whatever they happen to be when they come out. And my advice is put on a happy face, go to that shower, just remember how much you love your brother and how happy you are for him, which you said you're really happy for him, and stay in that space for those couple of hours for the shower or whatever it is that the family's planning. And just tell yourself later you can go home, you can cry, you can scream, you can punch some couch pillows about how unfair the world is. And that's cool because you have every right to feel like poop about your situation. Just don't do it when everyone is celebrating your brother. And you're a strong person. You can do this. You can be happy for your brother, and then you can go home and cry it out later.
I think there's a lot of sense in that. Kim, how about you?
First of all, just that phrase, "in a way that makes everybody feel good," I feel like maybe a Codependence Anonymous meeting might be helpful on that line, because it's not really her job to make everyone feel good. However, depending on how close you are with your brother, I would just have a private kind of sidebar and say, you know, I am so excited about your babies. I'm going through a hard time. So if for some reason I can't show up at your shower, I just want you to know I love you and I'm really into these babies. I'm going to be the best auntie ever, but I'm having a hard time. So I just want you to know that. So maybe he could be her ally against mom and the rest of the group. And then maybe not have to spread that out to the rest of the family, but the brother will know if she can't show why that is, and hopefully will respect that. But I would also like to say she's anticipating pain, and you don't even know how you're going to feel. She may find that showing up and celebrating someone else's good fortune gets her out of her head enough to maybe bring a little bit more positivity around the subject. So I always find that when you show up and are of service to other people, even though you don't want to be, you get out of your own pain. So that would be my last piece of advice.
That's good advice. And my advice goes to a rule that I often deploy, which is use your words. People are not mind readers. So in this case, the brother cannot read his sister's mind about why she might be conflicted or why she might choose not to come. So I do think it would be a very good idea for sister to have a conversation with him about all the things she's feeling, and then to make that a two-way conversation. In the end, I think that she should make an appearance. You know, what she doesn't necessarily need to stay long, but I think showing up for her brother and family and the babies to come is not that hard in the end, and may actually, as you said, Kim, bring her some joy that she's not feeling right now. That's a hard one, though. Let's move on to our last question for today.
Dear Civilist, about 6 months ago, my family moved into a new neighborhood. Almost immediately, we met a family who lives down the street, and they're just perfect. They have a son that gelled with our kids, they have a babysitting-age daughter, and the parents are kind and easygoing. They've even made overtures about going out to dinner with us as couples, which sounds just perfect, except for one major problem. They don't shut up. Neither of them ever, ever stop talking. We like them, but I don't really think my wife and I can go out to dinner with them. I don't think we can be real, authentic, genuine friends with them as if this issue is between us. But I'm not sure what to do about it. Do I tell them to limit their statements and responses to 2 minutes or less? Or do we just, you know, go with the flow and perhaps keep a distance from them?
He likes them. He really likes them, he says.
Yeah, you can tell.
My God. Kim, this question itself is so painful to me. What would you suggest that this questioner do with his chatterbox neighbors?
Well, as I have a daughter who needs babysitting, so the idea of a built-in babysitter, a babysitting-age daughter down the street is so tempting.
Oh, you are such an opportunist.
I almost put up with anything. But here's the thing. This is why you are never supposed to become friends with the first person who shows up on your door with a pound cake when you move into a new neighborhood, because inevitably you'll be like, oh my God, they're here again. You can't give away so much of your hand early on until you really get to know people. So I would really suggest no dinners out, make polite excuses, but certainly let the kids have at it. Hire the babysitter. Good fences make great neighbors.
Well, I know, but then how many excuses are you going to make to get out of dinner?
Just what I was wondering.
Many.
See, that's awkward, Kim.
There's a message. There's a message in that, and I don't know if you want to give that message.
Yeah,
well, you think they should just go out and endure dinner with these people?
Yes, I do.
So, Shireen, what's your advice here?
This was really hard for me because, yeah, we don't have time to hang out with the people we like in life, let alone the people who talk too much. But they happen to be your neighbor and you happen to have to run into them all the time. So I think, yeah, just go out to dinner once, see how that goes. Maybe it's not as bad as you think it's going to be. And then write in to us again if it's really horrible, and we'll give you advice on how to proceed from there, because this is tough.
You know, I liked how he said, I don't think we can be real, authentic, genuine friends. So my first suggestion is, how about being real superficial friends? You know, and then go out to dinner with a group of friends, dilute their impact.
Oh.
And you know, that is something.
Yes.
That is something I have learned from my very own family, when we would always invite friends to the family table to make it all go down easier.
That is that's why you're the Civilist. Genius.
Finally, you understand, Kim. Shireen and Kim, thanks for sharing your wisdom today and being a part of this program.
You're welcome.
We'd love to hear your questions about how to navigate tricky social situations. Please send a voice memo with your question to thecivilistpodcast@gmail.com or leave us a voicemail at 919-263-0929. I'm very excited to welcome Andrew Solomon to the Civilist Podcast today. He's a professor of clinical psychology at Columbia. His book, Noonday Demon, An Atlas of Depression, details his own struggles with that disease. I love that it won a National Book Award. And I have to say, it's a book that made a tremendous difference in helping me understand my own lifelong depression. It inspired me to write an essay that was recently published in the New York Times called Opening Up About Depression. Andrew, welcome.
What a pleasure to be here.
So let me start with this question. I've begun becoming more open with family and friends about my depression. Yet, you know, it's still new, it's scary for me, and it's often awkward. What advice do you have for those thinking about telling others, and especially the fear that people may see them as crazy or, you know, some other pejorative?
Well, I would begin by saying that it's relatively manageable to come out when you're feeling well, and it's often nearly impossible to do when you're depressed. I've had a public role as a sort of professional depressive now for nearly two decades, and still, if I have to cancel something because I'm feeling psychologically fragile, I can't bring myself to say it, and instead I conjure up sort of mythical cases of food poisoning or a variety of other excuses. Then when I'm feeling better, I can say, you know, when I missed that dinner a few weeks ago, it was actually because, but it's very hard to do it when you're in it. One of the symptoms of depression is shame, and that shame attaches to any available surface. So my first piece of advice is not to try to do it when you're at your lowest. It's something to do when you're feeling better. It makes people much less uncomfortable if you discuss it in the past tense, even if you discuss it with a potential future tense, which is to say that if you say to people, you know, I went through a really bad thing for a while and I suffered from terrible depression. I'm okay now. I know it might occur again, but I'm sort of holding on for the time being. That is much easier for people to process than if you say to them, hi, it's Andrew. I'm just calling because I want to kill myself and I feel life has no value and no meaning. That makes pretty people uncomfortable. It also makes people pretty uncomfortable.
Yeah, that's a dinner party downer, I would
exactly.
say.
And I think the other advice is that there are ways to test the waters, and it's something that should be done gradually. You don't have to announce it online to the entire world all at the same time. And you can often talk to people about other people and get a sense of what their attitude is. You can say, you know, a friend of mine has been having a rough time with depression recently, and he's sort of gone through this and that. 95% of people will respond to that by saying, oh, depression is so awful. Did he get good treatment? Has he found the right way? This is what's worked for, you know. And 5% of people will actually possibly say something mean and disparaging. If you figure it out ahead of time, then you can tell which are the people to tell and when to tell them.
You know, I noticed in the comments under my Times essay, most of them had a lot of praise for the courage in talking about it. But there were a number of individuals who basically said, why do you even need to talk about this? It's a private matter. I know I sort of really came to the place where I felt that it was important for people to know this part of me, because I found it also was taking a lot of energy to cover it up, those alleged instances of the flu or food poisoning or whatever that was. Is privacy different today that allows for more openness around this?
Well, let me give you a multi-part answer to that question. There are a number of reasons to come out. One is, as you say, that keeping a secret uses up an enormous amount of energy. It's energy that could be better expended on getting better. And people become so obsessed with the cover-up process that it saps them entirely. There's someone who used to run a major company who refused even to get mental health care coverage for his employees because he thought then they would suspect that he had a mental health problem, which they probably wouldn't have done. And he went to these extraordinary lengths to cover everything up. and then killed himself at the crest of his career and of his life. And I've gotten to know his daughter and his widow, and they've all said, if only he'd been willing to be open about this, there was so much help available, and he didn't get the help. For me, I'm gay. I spent many years in the closet. I came out in my early 20s, so earlier than some people, later than many others. And when it happened, I thought, I have now had enough of living with a gigantic secret. I'm afraid people will find out. And there was a kind of relief to thinking, I've had this problem. Everyone now knows that I've had this problem. There isn't something waiting to ambush me of people saying, you're not who I thought you were. You're somebody else. How on earth did this happen? So that's the second piece of it, is just that I think it's actually, in some ways, even though it can be traumatic to come out, it's very relaxing to have come out. And the third piece of it, when I listen to you talk about people's response to your, by the way, brave and remarkable article in the Times, is that I think all of us who are able to be well enough and to live in an accepting enough world so that we can come out without jeopardizing our very close personal relationships or our careers, there's a little bit of a moral impetus for us to come out if we can. Because the more people come out, the more common it seems. You know, there was that famous thing that a younger activist once asked Harvey Milk, what is the best thing I can do for the movement? And he said, go out and tell someone. Depression affects 25% of the population at some point during their lives. That's a lot of people, like spending a lot of energy on secrecy. And if people begin to understand how run-of-the-mill it is to suffer from depression, then it will ease their journey through it themselves.
Well, I can't tell you how many friends I've heard from in the days since that Times piece was published who came out to me about their own depression as a result. And so that really goes to your point. Let me switch gears a little bit. And for those who are on the receiving end of this kind of information or disclosure, what is the most understanding and supportive way someone can respond when they learn a friend or colleague has depression? And what should they not say?
There's a wonderful idea in the work on early childhood development of what is called reflective containment. If you have an infant and that infant bursts into tears and you go on laughing, the infant feels unseen. If you have an infant who bursts into tears and that causes you to burst into tears, you escalate the infant's distress because it suddenly seems even bigger and more terrible than the infant already thought it was. Good and intuitive motherhood, which is the area within which this work has mostly been done, usually requires reflective containment, in which you are responding to your child's distress, but also providing something that contains it. So you look concerned and disturbed, but also reassuring. It's all about mothers and infants, but it's actually effectively the best way to respond to adults who are coming out with this kind of information. You don't want to say, oh my God, you're kidding, that's so terrible, are you going to kill yourself, I'm so worried, what can we do? But you also don't want to say, well, yeah, everyone's depressed these days, take some Prozac, hope everything's fine. You know, you want to go in between there somewhere and find the reaction. And the word reflective is very important. There are people who have said to me, I am suffering from severe depression, whose whole tone of voice has indicated that they are really right at the brink. And they need someone to say, you are going to be okay, and I'm going to grab you back from that brink.
That grab back from the brink can be a hug. It's not only a metaphor, it can be literal.
It can be literal. And then there are other people who are giving the information, but who clearly don't want to go too deeply into it. But what I would say is the sort of overall point of view is that depression is a disease of loneliness. It's often instigated by loneliness. It sometimes causes people to become lonely by cutting them off from the other people they know. And it can take even people who are not objectively lonely and cause them to feel lonely. Mm-hmm. And if someone comes to you and says, I have depression, the suitable response is always, in effect, to say, you are not alone, and I will be there for you, and I will never love you or care about you less because of it. And sometimes you can express that with a great big hug. Mm-hmm. And sometimes you have to write an email. And sometimes you just have to keep calling three times every day over a period of a year and a half. And I mean, there are a million different ways to accomplish it. But the objective should always be to mitigate someone's aloneness and acknowledge the seriousness of what they feel.
It's really beautiful. And I would also add from my own experience that, you know, it's probably been about 3 or 4 months that I've been telling people. And people have come back to me over time and said, not in an intrusive way, but just, how are you doing? Those gestures have meant a lot to me. Andrew, thank you so much for joining us today.
It's been a complete pleasure.
Andrew Solomon is the author of Noonday Demon, which has recently been updated. Well, that's all for this episode. Next time, we'll have some bright college students in to offer advice about how to keep the peace this election season. The Civilist Podcast is a production of WUNC, PRI, and me. My producer is Rebecca Martinez. Mark Blasco wrote our theme song. I'm Stephen Petro. Thanks for listening. If you've enjoyed this episode, please subscribe on iTunes. Hey, maybe even leave a review while you're there. It really helps. Thanks.